The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's Trump's Trials and Tribulations, New York Trial Dispatch, April 22nd. I'm Tyler McBrien with Benjamin Wittes and Anna Bauer, and we're discussing the first criminal case to go to trial against former President Trump, the first day of opening statements. All right, welcome everyone to Trump Trials and Tribulations. We're doing a live recording right now, our first New York Trial Dispatch. Today is April 22nd. I want to jump right in. There's a lot to talk about. It's the first day of opening statements. But before we get into the substance, Anna, could you just give us some color? What was it like waiting in line, getting in there? Yeah, take us into the courtroom with you.
Yeah, well, you know, we actually, the three of us, Tyler, Ben, and I, went over to the courthouse last night at 11 p.m. To scope out the line situation because, as loyal Lawfare listeners know, I'm always concerned about the line situation. However, that was something that we didn't really have to worry about this time around because we do have a reserved seat in the courtroom, although we still wanted to scope things out. There were already a number of line dudes out there, but it actually was a bit surprising that there weren't more, I think, in part because, you know, in previous arraignments and really high profile night before a big hearing, there's just been kind of a media circus out in front of the courthouse. But this was a little bit more subdued. It was just a few dudes. It was quite cold outside. And then this morning, it was also very cold. Ben and I showed up at the courthouse around, Ben, what time was it? Maybe 6:45?
It was around like 6:30, 6:45. And we thought it was going to be pretty quick to get in because of your experience last week. They left us out there till 8:30 in the morning and, you know, standing still while waiting for Donald Trump.
I actually, another journalist had to give me one of his spare jackets because I was so cold. So shout out to the German press agency reporter who saved me from hypothermia. I was able to actually live tweet because my finger, you know, because I was able to stay warm. Otherwise, I think that my hands would have just been frozen. It was a little bit more subdued, in which I was surprised because I really expected it to be crazy. And then they, you know, kind of rushed everyone in there because we'd been waiting for so long. So I, you know, and then Trump came in, the mood was just a little bit not as momentous as I thought it would be in the way that some of these arraignments were. It was a little bit more, okay, we all know what we're doing. We're a little bit used to it after last week. And so let's get the show on the road.
That's great. And Anna, thanks for using the proper term, line dudes. That is their official name. Their title is dudes. So thanks for that. And before we go any further, Ben, I heard through the grapevine that a certain someone's dog shirt may have caused problems today in the court.
Yeah, I feel really bad about this, but of course I wore a dog shirt. But I also wore a hoodie on top of it because it was really cold outside, as Anna was saying. And so there came to be a rumor that I was not wearing a dog shirt. And this got back to me from the estimable Shane Harris, who texted me that he had heard Shane is not here. He's, you know, doesn't cover the trials, but that he wrote me a scandalized email saying that he'd heard I wasn't wearing a dog shirt. And so I went to the person who I presumed to have been his source for this false information. And I showed this reporter that there was actually a dog shirt. I turned out to be wrong. This wasn't the person who had told Shane. But this person immediately whips out her camera and says, "Oh my God, I have to take a picture of the dog shirt." Whips out her camera phone, and the security people descend on her like she had, you know, pulled a firearm or something, and booted her out of the court. And so, yeah, somebody was actually evicted from the press corps today over a dog shirt, and I feel really bad about it.
And rest assured, everyone, that was not an elaborate ploy to get rid of the competition. That was an honest mistake, I'm sure, on everyone's part.
Yes, I have no doubt that the person in question had taken out her camera to send Shane Harris a picture of a dog shirt, not to violate any of the court's rules. And so I'm a little bit miffed that they are being enforced in a fashion that is quite this zealous. The dog shirt in particular objects.
Well, with that settled, let's move on to what we were talking about today. And today was opening statements, but before those began, I understand Justice Merchan ruled on a few of the Sandoval hearing matters that we heard about on Friday. So, Anna, I'll go back to you. Can you quickly just remind listeners what a Sandoval hearing is and then what we learned from the judge today?
Yeah, so the Sandoval hearing involved argument over whether the prosecution, if Trump should decide to testify in his own defense, which he has said that he will or that he might, though I am really doubtful that that will end up happening. But if he does choose to testify in his own defense, the Sandoval hearing deals with this question of, you know, can the prosecution elicit responses or ask questions that relate to any, you know, so-called prior bad acts? So in this case, there were a number of different things that they wanted to be able to raise if Trump should take the stand. It included the civil fraud case against Trump that Justice Arthur Engoron presided over. It involved, you know, the defamation case related to E. Jean Carroll, and then also some of the findings in that civil fraud case in which Trump was held to have violated or was held in contempt, basically, of court and fined for violating one of the court's gag orders. And so we had this argument on Friday, which Tyler covered and has a great dispatch on. But we got a ruling from the bench from Justice Merchan today. And he basically said that, you know, these various categories related to the civil fraud case, the finding of Trump violating the court's gag order in that same case, the E. Jean Carroll defamation judgments, all of those things are things that the prosecution could elicit responses from Trump if he chooses to testify. He did say, however, that he will make sure to include a limiting instruction with it so that the jury is instructed that, you know, these prior bad acts are not things that it would be used to, you know, as evidence to prove up the actual crimes themselves. It would relate to things, you know, like impeachment of Trump's credibility as a witness and that kind of thing. So that is the ruling from Justice Merchan on the Sandoval hearing.
Yeah, I think it's actually quite a mixed ruling. I mean, he's letting stuff come in about each and every one of the six stuff, but it's six previous misconduct, but it's not, he's not letting the prosecution say whatever they want about it, right? Or ask anything. He sort of said, you can ask about X. And for each of them, he laid out what it is you're allowed to elicit from Trump about it. He did seem at least mildly concerned to prevent kind of a freewheeling cross that, you know, basically, at, you know, uses every case that's ever he's ever lost to say, but aren't you a scumbag who does this kind of thing?
Yes, he narrowed it specifically to, you know, particular findings, for example, that the court made, as opposed to just generally what things that might have happened in the course of the case. So I think that's an important point, Ben. Yes.
Right. And to give just one example of that, could you clarify, for example, what in the E. Jean Carroll case is permitted versus what's not?
So I believe that it is the fact that he was found to have defamed E. Jean Carroll in both October of, get my dates right if I'm wrong, October of 2023 and May of 2023. Is that correct?
I don't remember the specific dates, but it's both cases that he defamed her with actual malice and that he was assessed compensatory and punitive damages.
Right. And then there's also the one that I forgot to mention that I will just quickly mention as well is the fact that that Trump entered into a stipulated dissolution to kind of resolve claims by the New York Attorney General's office a dissolution agreement of the Trump Organization. And so that was another one as well. And again, very specific, right? As to, you know, just eliciting responses that are about that dissolution agreement. So that's just one more example of, you know, the kind of very specific way that he's crafted this order.
Great. So let's move on to the meat of the day, opening statements and then witness testimony from our first witness. But Ben, I want to go to you. You've I'm sure, listened to and sat through many opening statements. I want to get your impression first of the prosecution. What are the contours of this alleged conspiracy as they said it? Who was the prosecutor who was delivering the opening statement and how did he do?
So I was Colangelo. It was a very polished presentation. I thought, you know, just at the level of, you know, if you were grading him in a law school for, you know, oral argument or something, you would say he did very well. I think he was keen to foreground the election interference components of this case and very keen to background the porn star, Playboy model components of it. The story that he wants to tell and that he says the evidence will show is that at the time of Trump's election, at the time of Trump's announcement of his candidacy, he got together with his friend David Pecker, the chairman of the National Enquirer, and we're going to talk about the beginning of David Pecker's testimony. We only got like 20 minutes of it, but it was awesome. They got together and they agreed with Michael Cohen that the National Enquirer was going to play three roles on behalf of the campaign. It was going to be Trump's eyes and ears for negative stories about Trump, and it would try to squelch them. It was going to publish flattering stuff about him, and it was going to publish dirt on his opponents. And that then in the wake of this agreement, there were three major incidents where they did this eyes and ears thing, one involving this doorman at Trump Tower, one involving Karen McDougal, and one involving Stormy Daniels. And that then so all of this was done with a very keen effort to affect the election coming up and to prevent certain information from becoming public. And then in the aftermath of the election, there was essentially a scheme to falsify records in order to cover up that they had done that. And that's the basic story that he wants to tell. There's a bunch of nuances to it that he's really excited for the jury to get their, you know, to get testimony around. But that's the story. And it's a story that he very much wants the jury to think that this is sort of like the Russia election interference domestic version, and not you know, you shut up a porn star story. So that's the, I think, I don't know, Anna, what am I leaving out? But I think that's kind of the gravamen of Colangelo's opening statement.
No, I think that's exactly right, Ben. I actually don't have too much, I don't have much to add to that, that I think that that is right. Yeah, but.
Well, Anna, I'll stick with you then. Turning to the defense now, what did the defense say in terms of why everything about that was wrong? And I also want to hear your take on how Todd Blanch performed. You've seen him also in Mar-a-Lago because he's one of Trump's attorneys there. How did he do?
Yeah, so Todd Blanch delivered the opening on behalf of Trump, and we got our first look. It's been kind of unclear to me, at least, how exactly Trump's team plans to defend Trump against these charges, what the exact theory of the defense will be. And we got a clearer understanding of that today with this opening. And I think that there's two big parts to it. The first is that of course, the allegation here is that the falsification of these business records, the kind of core part of that falsification, is that this was a reimbursement for the payment, specifically the Cohen Stormy Daniels payment of $130,000, and that was then put in the ledgers and in invoices on checks as a reimbursement for legal services, when in fact, not reimbursement, as income for legal services, as opposed to, you know, a reimbursement for, as the prosecution put it, a porn star payoff. And so that is kind of the core claim as to what was false about these business records. And what Trump's team seems to be saying is that instead, actually, Michael Cohen was being paid for legal services. And to like really kind of hit home this point, Todd Blanch said to the jury, you know, the prosecution is telling you that this $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels, which was supposed to be, was what should have been reimbursed and should have been, you know, marked as a reimbursement. Trump paid $420,000 through this scheme to Michael Cohen over a period of several months. And the idea behind kind of raising this point in Blanche's view is that if Trump is this frugal businessman, then why is it that he would pay a $130,000 debt to Cohen by giving him $420,000? And of course, in the prosecution's theory, it all has to do with, you know, tax reasons and on grossing it up for that purpose. But in Blanche's view, the idea here is that, well, actually the reason that he got paid that much money is because he actually was being paid for legal services that he performed as a personal attorney to Trump. And he mentioned that Cohen also did legal services work for the First Lady, that kind of thing. And so we have this idea here as a part of the core of the defense, which is that Cohen was being paid for what really was legal services. And so there wasn't anything, you know, that was false about these business records. The second thing, too, that really came through in this opening by Todd Blanch is the question of credibility. A big focus of the argument was on Michael Cohen and why the jurors should not take him to be someone who is a credible witness. There's two reasons that Blanch set out as to why the jurors should not, you know, take Cohen to be credible. One is that he is someone who has pleaded guilty and been convicted of perjuring himself. He has lied in court before, and so the idea is that he could lie in court again. And then the other thing is that they were portraying Cohen as being someone who is obsessed with Trump and kind of blames Trump for his own, you know, personal or legal problems, and subsequently became obsessed with Trump, and that his financial well-being also depends on, as Blanche put it, destroying Trump. In that Michael Cohen has a podcast that is, you know, focused on various aspects of Trump world. And, you know, Michael Cohen goes and does media appearances about Trump and that kind of thing. And so the idea here is just that Michael Cohen's not credible. They also focused on Stormy Daniels' credibility as well. And then finally, you know, Blanche just ended by doing some kind of routine, asking the jurors to focus on the evidence and not on the fact that, you know, this is a former president of the United States, and not relying on things that, you know, they might see or know outside of court and just focusing on the evidence. But overall, I thought it was a very good opening on behalf of Todd Blanche. It seemed to be more restrained than some of whenever I've seen him in Judge Cannon's courtroom or before Judge Chutkan. I think that he has, or excuse me, I think it's just I think maybe only in Judge Cannon's courtroom I've seen him, but he has not exercised as much restraint as he seemed to be doing today, which makes sense because he's performing in front of a jury and not just in front of, you know, Judge Cannon and his client. So I thought that it was a very good opening. One thing, though, that I think is relatively minor is that there were two objections that caused the parties to then have to go up to Judge Mershon's bench and have some, you know, discussion outside of the earshot of the jurors. But it kind of interrupted the flow of Blanche's opening. But otherwise, I think that, you know, the defense that they're setting out is, as far as the other ways that they could have approached this case, it seems pretty smarter than some of the things that maybe they could have gone with. But I don't know if Ben has thoughts on that particular question.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah, so I, first of all, Blanche's opening, I agree with Anna. It was really well done, and I think honestly, in the spirit of, like, you know, we sometimes make fun of Trump's lawyers. This was an excellent presentation, and I'm sure there will be. He definitely kept everybody's attention. He made some very good points, and he made some points that will be really interesting to see if he can deliver on in terms of what he says the evidence is going to show. I think the most important thing that happened today, as you said at the beginning, Tyler, is that we got a first real look at the defense case rather than these, you know, dismiss the case because of this, or dismiss the case because of this, or delay it because of this. Here is the first time that the defense laid out what they are going to argue to the jury happened. And it has really three dimensions. The first is that there is absolutely nothing wrong with or illegal about a hush money scheme to influence an election. And I suspect the prosecution was a little bit surprised by, not by the degree to which Todd Blanche just kind of leaned in to say, hey, yeah, we signed some NDAs. The client signed some NDAs to try to squelch embarrassing stories. And, you know, there, and that was in the run-up to an election. That's called, what you call influencing election is what we call democracy. And so he was quite aggressive about that. And I think it was actually pretty effective. So the second element of it is everybody who's telling you who this story depends on, i.e. Stormy Daniels and particularly Michael Cohen, he didn't use this phrase, but I'm going to use it for him, are lying sacks of shit and you shouldn't believe them. And they all have vendettas against Trump and they're making money about it. And by the way, Stormy Daniels was engaged in an extortion scheme in the run-up to the election against Trump. And so the second element is don't believe these two key witnesses. I think they're going to be much gentler with David Pecker because of point number one. So David Pecker, you know, you get David Pecker is a party to this scheme that they say is in the highest traditions of American democracy. So they don't really have the need to attack him in the same way. And then the third element of it is, as Anna says, yeah, and Michael Cohen was paid as a lawyer so that there is no, in fact, falsification of the business records. He's just C.2, the lying sack of shit point. He's characterizing these perfectly ordinary retainer legal payments as part of this scheme, and reimbursements. And in fact, he's lying now. And I think that's the key. Layout of the argument of the defense. And I think the most interesting thing we saw today was just the presentation of that. And I thought Todd Blanche did a very nice job presenting it.
Yeah, so turning to briefly to the first 20 minutes of David Pecker's testimony, which, Ben, you called, quote, awesome. So I want to just stick with you quickly. Why was it awesome? And then also, if you could just maybe explain a bit of the legal strategy as you understand it for the prosecution in putting him first.
Okay, so it was awesome. I think the better word would be fabulous, actually. So imagine your vision of a 70-something-year-old former head of the National Enquirer. He comes in, he's got a white shirt with a jacket and a white tie on top of it.
Wait, he was yelling, so you can't... I think he's wearing a yellow tie, right?
Really? On the television screen, it looked
in court,
white.
Yellow.
Oh, okay. So the TV made him even more fabulous. He's got these perfectly circular glasses that frame his eyes exactly in circles. He's got a mustache and no beard. It's all perfectly salt and pepper. And he is like proudly scummy from the beginning. He describes his job as, and this is a quote, checkbook journalism. And he describes how his role is to buy stories and develop networks of doormen and limousine drivers and people who work in law firms to dish about celebrities. And that's about as far as we got in the testimony. But I just thought, if you imagine like the slime ball who dresses well and who's just kind of completely unapologetic of it, whose name would be David Pecker, if you imagine and ran the National Enquirer, if you imagined to yourself, what is this guy going to be like? That's exactly what
he was
like.
But Ben, you've got to do the David Pecker laugh that we all heard, which will not come through on a transcript.
Yeah, so at some point they are trying to clarify with him which are all his many different phone numbers. And they ask him, you know, does your phone number, your personal cell phone number, are the last four digits, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, yeah. And then they ask him about his home number and his office number in New York and his office number in Boca Raton, Florida, because of course he has an office in Boca Raton, Florida, right? And Colangelo says to him, or maybe it's Steinglass. I don't remember which prosecutor was doing this. He says to him, "Don't worry, it's not a quiz." And the guy goes, "This kind of
like the penguin in Batman."
Yeah, only like, just more sleazy than menacing. It was, and everybody was just like, "Whoa!" So yeah, David Pecker, I am so excited for the Thursday continuation of this.
Yeah, but I will just say, in terms of the substance of his testimony, other than just, you know, the like excellent color that Ben has provided us, we didn't get much further other than you know, him saying that he is the former CEO of AMI, which is the organization that was the parent company of the National Enquirer and a bunch of these celebrity tabloids. And then, you know, him kind of talking about this other guy, Dylan Howard, who's also someone who was allegedly involved in the kind of scheme to influence the election by either providing Trump with, you know, positive coverage or executing the catch and kill schemes. But it seems like Pecker is going to be someone who is quite central to the story. He was involved in, you know, this alleged meeting that occurred in August of 2015, to, you know, in which they discussed these having this catch and kill scheme, all of that. He was involved in the three payouts that were referenced as a part of this catch and kill scheme, including to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, and then the former Trump doorman who had claimed, apparently an untrue claim, but nonetheless had claimed that Trump had fathered a child out of wedlock with a former employee. So Pecker is someone who's quite central to the case, and I think that probably starting with him makes sense because he kind of is, you know, a big part of the, you know, factual universe with the story here that the prosecution is trying to prove, but also they're able to really kind of start telling that story through the evidence of, you know, from the very beginning, Trump was concerned about influencing the election with this kind of scheme. And so, Ben, if you have other thoughts about whether that's the strategy, but I think that is where they're going with it.
Yep. I'll just jump in. We have about a minute left, and I, much like Justice Merchan, think that punctuality is a virtue. So really quickly in this last minute, Anna, what can we look forward to tomorrow in terms of the contempt hearing and anything else?
Well, we have this contempt hearing that if folks remember, this was brought up last week by the prosecution, but Justice Merchan set the hearing for tomorrow. Justice Merchan said that he expected it to go until about 11. So I'm not entirely sure what to make of that, but it seems like he thinks that we will wrap up by then. Court is only going to go until 2 tomorrow, though. So then we will continue, I expect, with David Pecker's testimony. Tyler McBrien will be back at it. He'll be joining me instead of Ben tomorrow at the courthouse. And Tyler is much better and faster at typing than I am. So everyone should definitely look forward to his live tweets because they're great.
Well, I think that's all the time we have. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to our first New York Trial Dispatch. Ben and Anna, thanks so much for joining me.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.